It's a real pleasure to introduce former New Mexico Governor Gary Johnson, who's also the honorary chairman of Our America Initiative, which is an interesting new 501c4 group that is looking at debating all of the issues of the day, as well as Jeff Myron, an economist at Harvard that a lot of people in the audience know from his pathbreaking work on a cost-benefit analysis of the war on drugs. What we're going to do in a minute is Gary is going to give about 10 minutes or so of remarks, particularly about an economic plan for revitalizing the nation's economy through free market ideals and limited government that he's worked out in conjunction with Jeff. And then we're going to have questions and answers until there are no more answers or questions or flights out of Washington area airports.
First off, a really big thank you to Reason for hosting this. A big thank you to Reason for helping out in this endeavor. A big thank you to Jeff Myron, who has lent himself to this endeavor. And what is this endeavor? Well, this endeavor is Our America Initiative. This was something that, and I would like to introduce Ron Nielsen. Ron, if you can just wave your hand. Ron and I, about 8 months ago, came to the belief that things that needed to be said in this country weren't being said. And I wouldn't be here right now if what I'm saying is being said and didn't need to be said. We started this on December 9th, went online with OurAmericaInitiative.com. It is an advocacy committee of which I am the honorary chairman, allowing us to raise money and speak out on the issues of the day. You all have this. There's also a handout at the door. We were wondering how much interest would be generated in what I will call issues of the day. I will tell you that right now the interest has exceeded what I thought it would be a year from now. That's good and bad. The bad is that the country is in that kind of shape that these kind of ideas really need to be at the forefront. So what we did on the 1st of December, we launched Our America Initiative, and we came out with statements on all of the issues of the day. Included in that was the economy. And when it comes to the economy, stop the spending. I mean, first and foremost, stop the spending. Put an end to the fact that taxes are going up across the board, and then the deficit that this country is facing. Now, these were generalized statements in the brochure that's also available at the door. But as the result of the interest that has been generated, we're having to go a little bit further. And by going further, today is the unveiling of a three-point economic plan in conjunction with the opening statement, which really, I think, is a wonderful document. It's one page. I think that it describes in a detail not seen with our first iteration. And I will tell you that if there's more interest beyond this, we intend to drill down on every one of these issues that we've presented here to you today. And I think that best said is just to read from again, I'll call a document that I'm really proud of. Free markets and limited government are the linchpins of prosperity. Economic policy should foster entrepreneurship, innovation, and individual choice, not direct economic activity to satisfy political interests in Washington. Americans should be free to make their own economic decisions because individuals, not government, know what is best for themselves and their families. This freedom unleashes the creativity and enterprising spirit that fuels economic opportunity for all Americans. To achieve these goals, the U.S. must adapt these three approaches. And these three approaches: slash expenditures, cut taxes, and shrink federal government in the economy. And as this document will show you, There are those lines underneath each one of those three bullet points. I would hope that you would have questions, comments on any of what is written here. And I would also like Jeff to make a few comments, if you care to.
So what we've given in this document are, first, these three very basic, broad principles Governor Johnson outlined: slash expenditures, cut taxes, shrink federal involvement. And we've tried to give enough detail without getting into sort of the weeds at this point to make it clear that what the position is. It's not a, yes, we should cut expenditure, but we're going to, by reducing the growth of discretionary spending from 2.5% to 2.4% a year. We've focused on saying enough detail that you can see that the governor is really serious about it. It talks about taking on Social Security, Medicare, defense spending, the major components of the budget, so that you can actually make a difference in the amount of expenditure and in the way the federal government is involved in the economy. The same is true in the taxes, by being specific enough to indicate that we want major, major simplifications, major reductions in tax rates, and so on with other aspects of federal involvement. So let me stop there. Open it to questions.
Okay. Could you, in a very quick way, talk about the major cuts to, or changes to entitlement spending to Medicare and Social Security? Where does that come from, and what is the constituency for that change?
Well, at the heart of all this is cutting the entitlements. You all have seen latest estimate that I've seen is that we have $55 trillion in unfunded entitlement liability, and that's Medicaid, Medicare, and Social Security. These issues have to be addressed. Looking at free market when it comes to the delivery of Medicaid and Medicare, I think that those end up to be the heart of those reforms. When you look at Social Security, it involves an element of privatization, and maybe beyond an element. We're prepared to go forward with specific plans, also raising the eligibility age. I mean, this is just part of what has to occur. I read in USA Today just yesterday that Social Security is bankrupt. It's not 2038 that it's bankrupt. It's now. It's now. It's like tomorrow, but it's here. It's here now, and none of this is getting addressed. And that's what we want to say, is that all of it needs to be addressed. It all needs to be laid on the table. And for anyone that wants to put to go to sleep and think this is going to fix itself overnight, that's absurd. It's not being addressed.
I would just add that the constituency should be everybody who cares about their children and their grandchildren and so on, because unless these entitlements are slowed down, the tax rates that will be necessary to pay for them will absolutely crush the economy, and so nobody is going to be very happy 20 years from now, 50 years from now, and down the line.
Thanks. Wander the crowd. When you ask a question, please keep it short, make sure it's a question, and identify yourself. Terry, I'll start with you.
I'm Terry Michael. I run a program that teaches journalism about students about politics, making better journalists. It's kind of tilting at windmills. I am going to ask you a fairly political question. Everything I know about you tells me you're a consistent libertarian. Is there anything that would surprise us that you don't think that you are libertarianish on?
Well, just that I am a registered Republican and remain have every intention of staying that way. Well, I always take the fact that I would have a label of libertarian attached to me as a compliment. I always have considered that a compliment.
Over here.
Yeah. Governor. Jeremy Lott. I write for everyone. We tried to. George Bush tried to reform Social Security. He got absolutely nowhere. They didn't even get a vote in the Congress when you had a Republican majority in both houses. How are we suddenly going to get that now?
Well, first off, I think I'll line up as first to be embarrassed by Republicans that controlled Congress and the presidency and didn't address these problems. In fact, passed a prescription drug benefit that is adding trillions to the national debt. So regardless of whether or not this stuff goes anywhere, it needs to be put on the table and it needs to be debated, ferreted out, a process of vetting that if it doesn't happen, clearly we're bankrupt. We are bankrupt. You know, this notion about handing our debts over to our children and our grandchildren, I think we're beyond that. It's now. It's right now.
Over here.
Catherine Mangy Ward, Reason Magazine. I'm interested in what you have to say about the Paul Ryan budget proposal, and the more specific you could be, the better, both about how it fits in with what you're doing and what chances you think it has of actually making a difference.
Actually, I'm not familiar with it at all.
And, do you think it'll pass then? Thank you.
Mark Scribner, Competitive Enterprise Institute. I'm wondering if you could spell out your ideal immigration policy.
Well, ideal immigration policy would, first of all, that immigration's a good thing, that it's a good thing that individuals want to come into the country. We should make that as easy as possible. I would be opposed to the fence that's being built. I think that's not serving any real purpose. So make it as easy as possible to come into this country, work, be documented, make contributions to this government, be able to enjoy benefits that this government might be able to give because you're in the country with your family, being a productive element of that. Certainly the issue is illegal immigration, and I think it kind of ties with national defense, the fact that I would be opposed to what we're doing in Afghanistan and Iraq. I want to go out on a limb here and say that I'm just willing to bet that there are a couple of bases in the world that really need to be shut down. I'm going to go out on a limb and just say that I think that they exist and that needs to be examined. So all of this just says let's take care of our own house first. And so our own house first really is our borders, our national defense. But it seems to me that we're just spread out so thin that we've become ineffective and maybe even counterproductive.
Okay, and we're back here now.
Hi, I'm Christian McClellan. I'm a student at Georgetown Law. Given that current beneficiaries are such an interest group when it comes to reforming entitlement programs, how do you feel about means testing current beneficiaries for either Medicare or other programs?
Jeffrey, do you have an opinion? Now, I think that should be on the... Sure. I think all of it needs to be on the table.
It's a reasonable possibility. Reasonable way to slow the growth. I don't think that many economists would say it's the ideal way because it does have a negative incentive effect. It discourages working really hard because then your benefits, your income is taxed away. We, of course, do have a means-tested health insurance plan already in Medicaid. Okay, so I think most economists would suggest instead for Medicare increasing the age of eligibility gradually, not on people who are already retired or near retirement, for people who are, say, 55 and under, simultaneously with doing it for Social Security, and introduce into Medicare in particular more co-pays and deductibles so that when people make decisions about their health care, they pay at least some of the cost out of pocket, and therefore they think a little bit more about, is that really necessary, or can I find a cheaper way to treat this condition, can I avoid certain procedures, and so on.
Jeff hit it on the head when he said, look, for those that are already retired, I think there's an unfairness to coming in and making changes. But I'm willing to say that my generation has to step up to the plate here, that promises have been made that can't be met, and that these issues have to be addressed, and they have to be addressed now.
And over here.
Hi there. My name is J.P. Furr. I'm with the Washington Examiner. One of the things that I really appreciate is, you know, any new initiative that tries to bring this sort of discussion forward. But I've seen a lot of these initiatives happen, frankly. I mean, there are a lot of advocacy groups, a lot of nonprofits. So I guess to what extent are you concerning yourself with the strategy And how exactly are you going to get legislation passed or get this national discussion going aside from, you know, just your usual commercials or giving talks at colleges?
Well,
and second, I was just curious, how much are you going to be making in your salary as a part of this group?
As far as salary goes with this group, zero. No salary with this group. And regardless of legislation, regardless of any legislation, the spending has to be stopped. The current spending has to be stopped. So I would argue that that the President of the United States should be vetoing virtually all spending to bring it in line with less of a deficit. And I say less of a deficit because what's built in to the budget right now with entitlement is guaranteeing a deficit.
When you talk about slashing Medicaid, Social Security, these are programs that obviously benefit a lot of poor people. When you were governor of New Mexico, you vetoed tons of bills. And part of what I think you could accomplish with some of these proposals is get a broad cross-section of support, including some from Democrats. But some of these proposals Democrats have targeted as being, it's almost like a heartless agenda or something like that. What do you say to those critics who say that, you know, basically what you're proposing is heartless?
Well, that it would really be heartless to see this country bankrupt. It would be really heartless. I think what's already on the table is really runaway inflation going forward, and that's the worst tax of all. Money that gets made on a Monday is worth less on the Friday that you actually go and pick it up. And so this is really a return to freedom, liberty, personal responsibility. This country is no good to any of us if it's bankrupt. Jeff, do you want to add to that?
I would just emphasize that some of the policies that you mentioned are not the ones that are helping the poor. They're helping the middle class. Beneficiaries of Medicare, Social Security, okay, are by and large not poor, and so it's redistribution from one middle-class person to another. It's hard to see a good justification for that, and it generates all sorts of costs in the process of moving all those dollars around. So I think those particular ones don't even merit the heartless. Okay, so Medicaid, yes, but there are ways to introduce like very small copays. Medicaid, $5 copays, that would still give people some incentive to think about how much care they're purchasing without unduly burdening people of low income.
And we're over here now. Gary, by the way, it's brave of you to not to worry about inflation when you have a zero salary, right? So it's like, but here we are.
How's it going? I'm Eric Netcher. I'm a congressional staffer. I think all of us can. Congressman Stern, 6th District, Florida. Yeah, okay. I think a lot of what a lot of the harm in this country is done by the tax code. I think all of us can kind of agree on that. What are your feelings on some of the relevant proposals, whether it be the fair tax or flat tax or whatever type of tax, you know, tax change?
Actually, that's on the sheet, which is to adopt a flat tax on income or talking about the fair tax on consumption.
And over here.
Hi, I'm Dave Weigel with the Washington Independent. We're meeting under cover of what I think will be 40 inches of snow. And I wanted to ask, first of all, if you believe that man-made climate change is happening or a problem. And second, I bring it up in the context of that's one area some policy people think you can start finding more revenue to fund the government as it is. I mean, I don't know how much you can talk about that, but do you think there a carbon tax is a good idea? Are there regulations we should be repealing to bring more revenue in? I mean, I think you have some experience in this. Where can the government intervene, or where should it pull back on environmental and energy policy?
Well, one thing that Reason has helped me out when it comes to global warming is Bjorn Lomborg. I've become aware of Bjorn Lomborg, and for argument's sake, global warming is happening, that it's man-caused. That given, I think the effects of it are grossly exaggerated, and I think the amount of money that we're looking to spend on it is very, very, very misguided, and that a carbon tax cap and trade tax on carbon emissions would be very, very misguided and would do great harm to the American economy. Jeff?
I would agree with all that. There are assumptions under which a carbon tax, if implemented in a very thoughtful way, okay, accompanied by a reduction in other bad taxes, distorting taxes, so that you kept revenue neutral, could be a positive thing, but those conditions are not remotely likely to occur. And so in practice, okay, you're likely to have a huge cost with minimal demonstrable benefit.
Well, today we had a discussion at Mercatus that discussed the fact that on an ongoing basis, government regulation costs about $1 trillion a year. And that would be the cost to implement that regulation and the actual cost on businesses to carry out. It doesn't seem as though, as a generalized statement, what I saw as governor of New Mexico was that although regulation seemed to be well-intended, it oftentimes had the opposite impact. So regulation, of course, in a lot of instances requires legislative approval to get rid of. In other cases, administratively, regulation can be dealt with. But
I mean, one proposal that's in this program is to legalize marijuana. That would bring in billions of dollars of tax revenue. Okay, there are other crazy subsidies, such as for ethanol, okay, at the same time that we're imposing tariffs on cheaper produced ethanol from abroad. So, yes, there are lots of examples of changes in policy that make sense on the merit that would also happen to raise revenue. That's separate from whether we should be spending that additional revenue. Maybe we should just be using that to reduce the deficit, but certainly there are examples of the kind of thing you described.
And we're over here now. By the way, Gary, as a former competitive skier, are you pro-snow or anti-snow? Here, next question.
Anthony Randazzo from the Reason Foundation. Many of our economic problems right now stem from regulatory failure of the past 10 to 30 years. The House of Representatives has passed a financial services reform bill. The Senate is currently debating one. What issues do you see in our current financial services regulatory structure that you think need to be fixed? What solutions would you propose to solving Wall Street rules?
Well, I don't see it as adding regulation. I see it actually as enforcing regulation that was already in place, and that would have been the collateralization of home loans and certainly the banks. Just the failure of government, if you will, to enforce regulation that was already on the books.
Yeah, I would certainly agree with that. It's very hard to think of additional regulation that in reality will actually reduce problems so long as a government is creating a large incentive for banks and others to take on excessive risk. That's partly deposit insurance, and it's even more, of course, Fannie Mae and Freddie, and much even more broadly, the Federal Reserve being there as a backstop and trying to ensure investors that everything will be okay no matter how big a housing bubble we have and things like that. So unless the government stops trying to encourage risk, okay, all the regulation in the world is not going to make any difference.
We're over here.
Hi, I'm Matt Bandick. I'm a reporter at U.S. News and World Report. I read an interview that you gave with this magazine back in 2001, and you were asked about your political future, and you said that you think your political future would be impossible due to your stance on marijuana. So I was wondering what has changed. I mean, that was a long time ago, so I was wondering what has changed since then, if anything.
Well, when was that, like 2001?
Yeah.
So when I came out on the issue of really looking at drugs and examining the war on drugs, believing that it was a failure and stating that I would like to include legalization as a potential solution to the issue, I had no idea, by the way, that legalization presented such a compelling argument. But when I came out with that statement in New Mexico, my favorability went from 58 to 28 overnight. over the course of the next 3.5 years, I went to every nook and cranny in New Mexico explaining what it is that I was saying, and I was igniting a debate that took place in New Mexico that I would argue took place nowhere else in the country. When I left office with a 58% approval rating. So I think, and when I got out of office, I purposefully wasn't speaking out on the issues of the day. But 10 months ago, I'm not hearing issues of the day addressed. And over that period of time, I really think that legalization of marijuana, which is what I'm espousing, legalizing marijuana, I really think that the issue has come to a tipping point in this country right now. You saw Massachusetts decriminalize marijuana by a vote of 65 to 35 about 6 years ago. Denver voting to decriminalize marijuana on a campaign that was based on marijuana being safer than alcohol, something that I said very early on. I haven't had a drink in 22 years. I don't smoke pot. But having done both, I can tell you, marijuana is safer than alcohol. So I think opinion has changed dramatically over the last 8-9 years from when we would have spoken then. And I think maybe I still might be the only one out here talking about legalization of marijuana, even though 44% now of the American population, Gallup poll a couple months ago that says marijuana should be legal. I think with just a little bit of education, this issue is at a tipping point, and that we will have rational drug policy in this country.
We're back here now. And by the way, Gary, I'm sure you'll agree that 44% doesn't include stoners who can never answer the phone when the pollsters call. Anyway.
Right. And pointing out the obvious, when 56% of the population says to 44% of the population, you belong in jail for your activity, that's bad law.
Another question?
Chris Catagnani, I work for the SEC. Irrelevant to the question. You mentioned some of the major expenditures and how they have the power to bankrupt the country. Given the relevance of that to everyone who's here today and in our future, why do you think the mainstream media is not giving that more attention and creating hype, I guess, to make it more aware to?
See, I guess I have the opposite take. I really think that this attention is being created. That really, right now, it's never been more prominent or predominant that we have to do something about this. That's my sense.
We're over here now. And by the way, I want to point out that Gary is already having an effect. The federal government has just shut down for the third consecutive day. If we can keep him going another 40 minutes, we may have a balanced budget by the end of the week.
Hi, John LeBaume. I write for the Washington Examiner Opinion Zone blog. Inevitably, you'll be compared to Ron Paul. He has challenged, opposed virtually every trade agreement on sort of grounds that it brings more government on a micro level rather than breaking down bigger trade barriers. You're from a border state of, between the North and South, but on the border of Mexico. So you've seen NAFTA probably have an effect on your state. How would you deal with future major trade agreements? Do you support NAFTA? How do you feel on trade, basically?
Well, overall, first off, when I found out that Ron Paul was opposed to NAFTA, I thought, well, gee, I thought Ron Paul was pro-trade. Well, he opposed NAFTA on the basis that it restricted free trade. I thought that overall NAFTA promoted free trade, and I do believe that overall. But I'm also a Ron Paul fan. I am absolutely a Ron Paul fan, and I think that he has consistently stood up for principle. I will just tell you that New Mexico, when it comes to workers coming over the border from Mexico, it's the cream of the crop, that it's a real asset. And again, I would argue that there has been increased trade. I couldn't stand here and tell you on the basis of what Ron Paul would have been opposed to with NAFTA that would have restricted free trade. I can't tell you what that is.
We're over here now.
Hi, I'm Pia Catton. I'm with Politico. You said that in the beginning that if there's interest, you'll drill down on more issues. What would be your next couple of issues that you'd address after economics?
Well, any one of the other issues. I just think that economics really is the issue of the day. I mean, that without getting our fiscal house in order, this country isn't anything to anyone. So what I was speaking of was drilling down with regard to these economic policies even further on a line-by-line basis. And for that matter, if you have a request that you want to put in on any of these others, well...
Well, yeah, actually, I mean, you mentioned in this that you would eliminate the government support of Fannie and Freddie. I mean, that seems like a huge change. Have you really thought that through?
Oh, well, totally. And let me just... again, Jeff does a great job of stating this.
I mean, of all the things in that, I think eliminating Fannie and Freddie is just a total no-brainer. I mean, first of all, Fannie and Freddie are not about helping poor people afford housing. Section 8 housing vouchers, okay, or general cash transfers are about helping poor people afford housing. Okay, Fannie and Freddie was huge handouts to rich bankers on Wall Street and had some effect on allowing some people to buy homes that were too expensive for them and that in many cases they're going to end up losing. So I think that eliminating Fannie and Freddie is absolutely crucial to having a sensible housing policy in this country. And I don't think it would be controversial in the least amongst a broad, broad swath of economists, whether they thought of themselves as liberal, middle of the road, hardcore free market, or whatever.
What you have right now is Fannie and Freddie with assets on their books that really aren't reflective of what those assets are valued at. So getting rid of Fannie and Freddie really is privatizing, allowing Fannie and Freddie to return to what they were supposed to be originally without, and government needs to take its right down and get out.
We're over here.
Robert Clemmer, intern with Americans for Tax Reform. Just interested in, ideally, what is the proper role of the federal government and the proper role of state government?
Well, a Tenth Amendment. As governor of New Mexico, I saw firsthand that really it's the homogenous 50 states rather than 50 laboratories of democracy. Be great, as is written in the Constitution, to return to these 50 laboratories of democracy across the board, that you could actually have best practices, which is something that I would argue doesn't currently exist. I would go to governor association meetings that was supposed to be about best practices, and every single governor would have a stack of stuff that they'd push over the table. By stack of stuff, so many good practices. Well, in fact, it was what everybody had to do to just survive. You know, I had the one sheet. I did have the one sheet. Everybody should have just had one sheet, and maybe we could have had, really discuss the good practices that were taking a place in the 50 states. So I hope that gets at it.
I think we have exhausted the audience. Gary, can I ask you just as a final question before we wrap up for tonight, when you were governor of New Mexico, what is the legacy that you are most proud of? What do you think was the best thing that you did to leave the state a better place than you found it?
Well, I would hope that it was that and of course that would be those volunteers and those individuals that I paid to be on staff and head the various agencies and what have you, that we really tackled the issues across the board, that there was nothing that we didn't put on the table in other words, what should have been on the table was on the table. Without exception, and we would have lost on those. dozens of bills that I would have proposed to abolish boards and commissions. None of them came to fruition. That never got to my desk for signature. The abolishment of half a dozen agencies that didn't come to my desk for signature. The fact that in New Mexico I proposed a defined contribution retirement plan as opposed to defined benefit, which I said that the state's retirement system was a Ponzi scheme. And that just points to another issue that all of us are going to face here, which are all these bankrupt state pension plans that the federal government is going to be looking at bailing out. So, my legacy, that I took it on, that I just took it on A through Z.
All right. Thank you all for coming. And thank you, Jeff Myron of Harvard and Gary Johnson of OurAmericaInitiative.com. And thank you all for coming on a cold and snowy night. Please continue to talk with everybody. Thanks.